Hey, Rejects, I'm Brent.
I'm Dave. Welcome back to Rejected Central.
Rejected Central, as you fine people know, is a podcast that seeks to, quote, elevate the rejection experience, unquote. No wallowing. Not much. Just a little. That's right. Before we get into things about the commercialization of gaming, we wanted to say again, just thank you to our listeners for your support and a reminder that we just can't do any of this without you. Right, Dave?
Absolutely. We're so grateful for all of our listeners and all their ideas.
For sure.
Please send
us,
them in.
Yeah, absolutely. Send us those ideas, feedback through email, social media. We'll have details at the end of the episode. And if you like the pod, the best thing you can do is share it. So tell everybody about it. Share with your friends.
Tell your colleagues. Tell everybody. Because this is a family-friendly podcast and you can listen to this at work.
That's true.
So why wouldn't you?
That's right. You know, sometimes we forget to actually say that, don't we? That this is a safe for work podcast.
We are a human
podcast.
Because there
are so many that aren't.
Yeah.
So we're going to turn towards gaming. We're going to look at how games went beyond just fun. From simply buying a game and playing it, with the move on to screens in the late 1970s, to now with its incredible, it being gaming, its incredible proliferation online, gaming has become mega, mega business. Sure, lots of companies always made money back in the day when gaming was just in real life, and you can still buy games and play them in real life and on your devices, of course, but gaming feels just bigger than just play. And that's why we're going to talk about it. Maybe games, and maybe we should reject the idea that games should be about money. Maybe we should refocus on fun rather than making money.
Who knew?
Who knew? Or are we crazy? Joining us today is Matthew J. Spearglass. I added the J because that was in the email. He actually goes by Matt. So, hi, Matt. Welcome to Rejected Central.
Hey.
Yeah. He's a neighborhood friend of mine and a lover of gaming, comics, film, and basically all things cool. He's a drama and media teacher, an actor, theater director and producer, and lifelong geek. And thank you so much for using the word geek.
Yes.
For almost anything fantasy or sci-fi related. And a recovering podcaster as well. This is a safe space for you. You need to know that. Yeah. Welcome again to Rejected Central.
Welcome.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, we did ask you earlier, where can people find you if they look to want to connect with you online?
For sure. I am reachable on Instagram as Matt_SZP.
I'll make sure I put the actual spelling and everything in the show notes for sure.
Right on.
And you mentioned you don't have a website, but I think that's actually a really good thing. You can't trust anybody with a website these days.
No.
You're the worst. No, that's fine.
Yeah, or email. It's like Matt SZP inquiries. If you have a burning question that someone with, you know, no real expertise, if you just need pontification on command, I am an email away.
And nobody
you're in the right place.
Does it better either. All right, so today we're going to do a bit of a case study or case studies in what's gone wrong with games. And we're going to focus very specifically on something many of you will be familiar with, D&D or Dungeons & Dragons, which I have to say, after digging into it, much to my great nostalgic pleasure, is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. Which is very cool.
Wow.
Before we get into the stuff of this, can you talk a little bit about your background with games and why you're so passionate about it? I guess why you thought you'd like to talk to us, you know, basically.
Why do you want to talk to us?
Why would you want to talk to us?
You're just so personable. And you're close, so it's convenient.
I'm taking notes. I'm taking notes. Spread the word.
Steps away.
Yeah. No, I think I'm certainly in the Nintendo generation games, both electronic and I kind of came to games like D&D backwards. I first discovered role-playing games on the Nintendo Entertainment System.
Okay.
And then as I kind of got older, I was at McMaster Sports Camp and I was the same age that my son is now, 11, 12 years old. And we're all sitting in lines and this camp is huge. There's like hundreds of kids with all of their bags and stuff all exploded all over the periphery of the university gym. And I look over and I see this hardcover book and I was already a bit of a reader, a bit of a geek for books. So, you know, I'm looking over and I'm like, oh, that's cool. And it's a picture of like, it's this, like this old white bearded wizard, but he's on this like kaleidoscopic background. And there's something that looks like the neck and head of like a red dragon rearing around, breathing fire at him. And I'm just staring and I'm like, what is that?
Now, I know there were different variations on that cover throughout the years, mm-hmm. but I swear that was exactly the same cover, the same cover that my brother had for his Grandmaster book or whatever you called it.
Yeah, the Dungeon Master's Guide.
Thank you.
I was looking at. But yeah, I ended up, I found the kid. He was an older camper, and I asked him, like, what is that? And he said, oh, it's a D&D book. And, you know, and he was a little standoffish at first. And only now, like looking back years later, I realized like he was waiting for me to make fun of him. Because back in the day, like D&D was not as questionably cool as it is now. It was way less cool.
Way underground.
When I was a kid, like it was akin to like, you know, it was almost like having like a social cold sore to admit that you played D&D.
Accurate.
Woo.
Accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. You weren't getting a date on Saturday night if you were playing D&D.
No, that's,
you might have been playing D&D because you couldn't get a date on Saturday
night. Oh, there you go.
Turn around.
This is an Ouroboros of geekery.
There's your moment of Zen.
Well, for me, it was back in the 80s, early 80s, and my brother was really into it. He had that book that I said. He drew all his maps on graph paper, and he had his similarly minded friends in the furnace room in our home, which was this little cave-like crawl space. And I used to sneak down to listen to them talking this unbelievably strange language, trying to decode what was going on. There was strange dice with so many different sides. How could you possibly make sense of it? He was really into like the little lead figurines.
Mm-hmm.
So much lead back then.
So much.
Yeah, no. And the version of D&D that you're describing, it's a bit the gateway. Would you call it that?
Yeah. It was my gateway.
Right.
Ironically, this is the second edition of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons.
Okay.
Which was a bit of a, although certainly like a creative and like generational touchstone for kids my age who were getting into it at the time, compared to the first cut of D&D in like 1974 and 75,
right.
and the advanced version that they did in 78 and 79, this second edition sold much less. It was far less popular and successful, despite being in some ways a better game.
Okay.
But in other ways, it was very much paying for the sins of its predecessors. The check had come due for the satanic panic of the early 80s.
Right. Play those records backwards.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Well, and that's, I mean, I, how can I put this very gently? I grew up in a community that basically saw anything to do with wizards and dragons as, well, unless you were reading Tolkien, then it was okay. Or C.S. Lewis.
Always a condition.
It was not okay. And it was really, and I know my brother would back me up on this. He would not have been openly discussing that outside that little cave space that he and his friends were in, right? I'm going to speculate. I think even my mom and dad were a little, about it. Yeah.
It did have a reputation, though, for sure, back then. I remember just not liking it because I didn't understand it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But there was certainly a stereotype of that game.
Yeah.
At least until I became an adult.
Well, that is a deep, deep, deep rabbit hole to go down. But the just the sheer bad faith reporting that led to the satanic panic against D&D and the ongoing stigma that it's born because of it.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, there's plenty of nits to pick, you know, with the game, especially in the early editions. There are a lot of attitude, like a lot of their phraseology and their depictions of other ethnicities. You know, the fact that they could, one of the early source books for AD&D was called Oriental Adventures.
Oh.
With like a completely straight face.
Yeah, well.
And, you know, it was a book taking a sort of Tolkien-esque adventure and transporting it to what a bunch of dudes in Lake Geneva thought the ancient Asia was like. Yeah. And
right, of course.
It's not a depiction that holds up.
Right.
Let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Fair.
No, that is fair. Even books that I read back then, it's the same idea, right? A lot of basically middle-class white guys writing about cultures that they just had no idea about. You know, I saw a preview. It popped up on the screen last night for Shogun. The one that I'm thinking of, the book itself, the movie, and then the original book by James Clavell or whatever it was. Again, a very colonial attitude, and you know, he attempt to be as respectful to the Japanese culture as possible. Mm-hmm. But in the end, you read it now, and it's pretty cringeworthy.
Yeah, it's funny actually. I've never read it myself, but the film, the miniseries they made in the 70s. Is one of Quentin Tarantino's, one of his foundational texts as a filmmaker. And I was a huge Quentin fan when I was a teenager.
Okay.
So, you know, I'd spent years wondering, like, should I read this? And I did some digging on it. And I'm like, how did people in Japan receive this book when it came out?
Right, right. And Last Samurai happening later in the 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, and the response, and I think it goes to the problem of this sort of appropriative issue. Was that the critical response in Japan was like moderately good, but only because previous Western depictions had been so poor.
So bad. Mm. Yeah. When it comes to D&D, I mean, if we're going to talk about the then and the now, I mean, it's evolved a lot. And of course, D&D, along with a lot of those IRL games, have moved online, both with publishing and playing. How has the D&D world changed for you now, as a gentleman of a certain age?
Gentleman of
a vintage, if you will.
Yeah, I'm either a late Gen X or early millennial, depending on where you split that lack of hair.
But they're both. I need to say, both gentlemen are rubbing their heads right now.
I mean, hairline resembles more of an X these days, but okay.
Just remember, this is radio, people. Make sure you describe. Yeah. I am now rubbing my forehead.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I am now indicating the growing, balding pate on the top of my head.
Growing?
Things change. They do change.
Yeah.
Oh, so how did D&D change for you? Are you still playing?
Well, yeah. The biggest change is that it's gone from an in-person activity to an online activity. As the group I played with has spread out, I've got, there's a group of four of us that play like once every 2 weeks. You know, we, at our height, maybe this time last year, we were playing weekly, but, you know, schedule and time being what it is, we had to dial it back. But we play, using a virtual tabletop. Mm-hmm. When we used to play in person, one of us is my good friend Mark, is an architect. So he always loved drawing out the maps and, you know, using the lead miniatures to show where everyone is. And, you know, we loved painting everything, doing everything by hand. But by and large, when we were playing, it was in the style called Theater of the Mind, where the storyteller, the dungeon master, sort of keeps track of precisely where everyone is on the imaginary game board, and then reports what each player sees. Like, you basically assume the role of their five senses. And then they make decisions based on that, and the storyteller sort of adjudicates, based on rolling the dice, what happens. Since going to a virtual tabletop, now everything is visual.
Right.
And creating a map just takes using, like, a Google search, copy paste, and, you know, dragging a grid over it. It's very often intuitive. You know, depending on what app, what virtual tabletop you're using, there's quirks, learning curve.
Sure.
But it's somewhere between like Photoshop when it's at its hardest, or like, something purely like just drag and drop, very, very easy when everything's working right.
It sounds like an awful lot of apps in general, right? I mean, some work really well and very intuitive, others not so much, right?
As far as creativity is concerned, is it better to do it virtually or in person? Like, because it just, it's occurred to me while you're talking, you know, like your friend is setting up maps and, you know, others are doing their own thing over in this way.
That's an excellent question. For myself, I notice that in the switchover from like the in-person theater of the mind stuff to the virtual tabletop, it's creative in different ways. It's almost like, trying to do a push-up with elbows out and then trying to do a push-up with elbows in. You're doing the same thing, but you're using very different muscles.
Right.
With the virtual tabletop, you know, I've had to teach myself a little bit more about using visual tools to edit maps, to use, to sort of import assets and design visually, which is something I'm a big fan of, but doesn't come to me naturally.
Okay.
What attracted me to the game first as a player and then as a storyteller, dungeon master, as it's called in the game, but I have always found that term to have uncomfortable connotations.
Mm-hmm. As the game has evolved, Hasbro, of course, who's not the original owner of the game, and we'll talk a little bit more about that a little later, who, much to my, again, incredible, like huge industry. We're talking about stock exchange value, $7 billion worth of sales last year, even after a 14% decrease. Like, holy crap, that is a big company. So as Hasbro was gearing up for the 50th anniversary, it decided to alter what's called the Open Gaming License, or OGL. So what is that?
The OGL is a relic from an earlier time. In the year 2000, D&D was in trouble. 3 years earlier, it had been purchased by Wizards of the Coast, a Seattle-based company famous for creating the Magic the Gathering card game and the collectible card game genre. D&D had been hemorrhaging money for basically a decade, and was really on the cusp of maybe fizzling out in the late 80s. So one thing leads to another, and Wizards of the Coast purchase it. And shortly thereafter, you know, less than a year later, Hasbro moved to purchase Wizards of the Coast. So by the time the year 2000 rolls around, D&D's product line is extremely overextended. They have far too many products producing at a low level. Sales are just diminishing returns from end to end to end. And Hasbro's looking at them like, maybe this is an IP that we can sort of put to bed for a little while. And to something that is such... for a game that has such a small but dedicated core audience, this was apocalyptic. So the survivors of the great Wizards Purge put their heads together and came up with a plan that they pitched to management, which was, we'll do a third edition of the game. And this third edition is going to address a lot of the perceived and real problems that existed in the second edition. We're going to lose the name Advanced from Dungeons & Dragons because it's scaring people away. They think you need a degree in order to play the game. I mean, you know, maybe they weren't entirely wrong. But they were going to make it... The design sort of motto was easy to learn, difficult to master.
Right.
Which was a phrase that they had imported from Magic the Gathering.
Okay.
Facing cancellation, the product lines were all pared back. They went back to just the core three books, one campaign setting. One thing that's particular about D&D is a lot of the adventures are set in a shared universe. Very much spinning out of the Marvel comics at the time, which now through the Marvel Cinematic Universe... everybody,
sure,
you know, people are, this, the idea of a shared universe is now super duper common.
Boy, talk about overextended, right?
Yeah. Right? Yeah,
but this is like a very common story you're telling, right? A company recognizes that it's overextended. Unfortunately, so many don't. But tries to correct it somehow, right? Like, yes, the Marvel thing is really its own beast, isn't it?
The way D&D approached its realignment was very much prescient to how Marvel is realigning its movies now.
Okay.
In order to sort of get back to their core audience, they're extending a proverbial olive branch. And that's kind of what the Open Gaming License was.
Okay.
Up until this third edition, if you wanted to produce a Dungeons & Dragons product, and when I say product, that really meant one of two things. Either a what was called a boxed set, which was sort of like a board game containing a few softcover rulebooks, fold-out maps, you know, punch-out characters, and each of these boxes would describe, like, a full game world where you could be in the same shared universe as everyone else using that box. The other kind of product was something called an adventure module, and the adventure module was basically a plot line, a series of maps and incidents for the players to work their way through. The box sets were the NES and the adventure modules were the cartridges.
Okay, okay.
If you wanted to produce either of those, you had to work for TSR initially, and then you had to work for Wizards of the Coast, or you had to work for Hasbro. You had to be in the industry, and you know, getting into gaming, much like getting into anything, any industry that's very niche and very geek, where the audience is very, very creative. You know, it's like breaking into the industry is like breaking out of jail. As soon as somebody does it, they seal that way shut.
Okay.
So it's very, very difficult to get in. And what a number of the game designers from earlier eras of Dungeons & Dragons we're finding is once you're out, it's hard to get back in. So the Open Gaming License was a bit of an olive branch to fans who wanted a way in, who wanted to express their creativity and share what they were creating, and maybe get a little bit of experience publishing and getting into game design.
Okay, that sounds really nice.
Yeah.
You know, who doesn't love when somebody who has wronged you extends that olive branch? I sense a but.
Well, for a long time, there was no but.
Okay.
The Open Gaming License required people to, you know, publish a pre-written page or two of legalese in the front and back of your book, and then you were free to use the core mechanics of Dungeons & Dragons in whatever you wanted to publish.
Okay. And we're talking publishing, where it's not just somebody doing it in their cave, in their basement, making a new product. We're talking commercial.
Right.
Okay.
This is where people, and you saw dozens of these sort of cottage game companies springing up. Many of them spearheaded by former D&D designers. Skip Williams, for example, started a line called Sword and Sorcery, which used the third edition rules, but had its own sort of its own unique game setting, its own lore, and you know some tweaks, you know, some modifications to the system, but still within the Open Gaming License. And the idea was that if you could play D&D, you could play any of these games.
Okay.
This was great for designers and fans because it made a really, really simple, a very simple common language so that you could go and, whether you were at a convention or at a friend's house or a local gaming or comic store, chances are you knew the basics of how to play any tabletop role-playing game.
Okay.
And this was great for D&D because it spread knowledge of the brand and the system. The number one problem that D&D's designers were faced with in the early editions was trying to teach people how to play.
Okay.
You know, it's a game where if you were to pick up a D&D product with no idea what it is, you would open these text-dense hardcover books, and it's like, how is this a game?
Yeah.
And the OGL helped to bridge that by making it a lot easier to learn.
Okay. Okay.
And that sounds perfect because I don't know, if I were to take my one of my favorite IPs, I mean, I'm a huge Mario Kart guy. I mean, we're switching to video games just for a second here. If I could create my own tracks, wouldn't that be amazing? So I can see why you were very, with the OGL, I can see why you're very enthusiastic about it, because it's like, well, you're kind of letting us in through the front door and, you know, touch the items, right? That sort of thing. So that must have been, at the time, you must have been just like out of your head with this, right?
It was a very, very cool time. I was old enough to know better, but not quite old enough to shake it off entirely.
Right.
I never got into the publishing game myself, but just being a fan at that time, you could not go in to a game store or a comic shop without there being something new on the shelf.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And D&D, up to that point, you know, even though it was quote-unquote overextended, there were too many different game worlds and it was just spreading the fan base too thin. Now fans themselves were generating, sort of taking what they were building at home, editing it, turning it into a polished product, and putting it out. And rather than spreading the same butter over too much toast, it was adding more butter. Mm-hmm. It was bringing more people in. Because, look, not everybody wants to reenact Lord of the Rings, which is the, you know, which is sort of like the default tone for, well, more or less the default tone for D&D out of the box. Some people would much rather live in a world more like Neil Gaiman's writing, where things are more lyrical. It's not really about how hard can I hit some dude with an axe. It's about clever wordplay and, you know, solving puzzles. These are all things that the D&D game has almost always been able to do systemically. But because of the sort of the tone of any given campaign world, any official product's tone, a lot of people didn't feel like those itches were being scratched.
Yeah.
Some of the breakout success stories of the OGL era were steampunk-inspired settings. Privateer Press's Iron Kingdoms, for example, takes almost like a Warhammer approach, the sort of these giant armies, but instead of, you know, orcs and elves, it's, you know, these steam-powered robots and, like, dudes with, like, lightning weaponry and...
So anybody could really come into the sandbox and play.
Right.
And make a little money at it at the same time, if things went well. And this continued for a while, right? Like, yep. And that's a good thing.
Now,
the but is where Hasbro steps in.
Yep.
In advance of the 50th. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
20-odd years later.
It's, yeah, right? It's quite a history.
Yeah. Mm. And, I mean, there have been some ups and downs. In the intervening period, D&D goes through a fourth edition that is enormously divisive. The game sheds a lot of its fans. It almost fizzles out entirely. That's another story. But by the time we're coming up to the 50th, a fifth edition has come out, and the game, for the first time, D&D is not in trouble. It is one of the two properties that Hasbro owns that is consistently making money and showing growth year over year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
COVID brought a lot of gamers back to the table. Mm-hmm. And the proliferation of virtual tabletops, online communication tools like Zoom and Discord, the explosion of podcasting, mm-hmm. and the popularity of shows like Critical Role, that basically take a game of, well, at first Dungeons & Dragons, and then Pathfinder, and then Dungeons & Dragons again, and playing them live, quote-unquote, over a microphone with very talented voice actors and, an absolutely transcendent storyteller. It's made D&D bigger than it has literally ever been. Even D&D adjacent stuff like Critical Role now has Amazon streaming series. They have millions of listeners. everything sort of seems to be going pretty good. Sales are all right. Then in 2022, they hit a couple of speed bumps. Some new adventures and some new rules fall short of that cultural sensitivity line. And a number of fans openly, like online, sort of raise Cain? Raise?
Raise hell. They raise hell.
Raise hell.
Hell's like, a work safe word.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. The raise hell against the company. There's online campaigns and material is redacted and rewritten. Okay. Apologies are issued. We'll do better. We have a diversity committee now. And then the next book comes out and they don't do better.
Okay. Yeah. Not an uncommon story as a reaction to the perceived wrong that's been done. Suddenly, as though you can legislate a solution to a non-legislative problem, or you can create a solution to a non-creative problem and fix people's mindsets, which you just can't do, right? You just can't fix it that way.
As they're working through these very public sort of squalls of poor popularity, in December of 2022, a proposed amendment to the Open Gaming License is leaked to IO9. Which is sort of a gaming reporting website.
Okay.
And these the Open Gaming License has been stable more or less since its inception.
Right.
Now, some of the changes that they're talking about are like a 25% royalty on any Open Gaming product that makes more than, you know, a certain benchmark of money. It would give Hasbro unlimited use of any IP created under the OGL.
There you go. There's your chestnut.
Yeah. There's the butt.
Yeah. And this was a reaction to the success of things, you know, not so much like Iron Kingdoms, but Critical Role and Eberron was another success story from that era. Where these are D&D sort of spin-off products created by fans turned designers.
Yeah.
These are sort of people that grew up playing the games. These were the people who were the kids in Stranger Things. Hmm. And as they grew up, they saw this way into the game that they loved to play, and they took it. Mm-hmm. And they sort of took it on faith that the Open Gaming License would be, you know, would continue to behave as it always had. And, you know, whatever steps the parent company was taking to, you know, squeeze a few more dollars out of the audience, that's, you know, that's the price of doing business. And that wouldn't stop anybody from using the OGL to make whatever they wanted to make.
But we're sure talking about a big difference between that and suddenly injecting a little bit of legalese into it that says, oh, by the way,
we own your thoughts.
By the way, we own your thoughts.
We own your creativity. Yeah. We own your thoughts.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. And I'm going to guess here that it's retroactive as well.
At 100%.
Yeah. Wow. See, now this is...
That's Nestle level.
I don't know. Are we allowed to say businesses can get greedy sometimes?
Back up there.
Yeah, they definitely took Art Scratchia Artists and turned it into Art Scratchia Avarice. Like, it was just a monstrous pivot.
Okay, so how's the response? Because we're kind of in the middle of this right now, right? Mm-hmm. We have you sitting here next to us with obvious strong feelings about it.
Yeah.
What's happening in the community like right now?
The community at the time...
Are we talking about the difference of just a couple of years here? We're talking about 2022 when the thing was leaked. And you're already talking about it at
the
time.
In the past tense,
So many things have happened since then already?
Yes, it's been...
worse?
After the leak, there was a hurricane of apology statements and backpedaling and retraction.
We're going to do an episode on rejecting backpedaling.
I think. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, I take that back. I take it back. Sorry.
Well, I think there are certainly times where, you know, whether you are a big company or an individual, you know, your job is to, you know, as Captain America says, you know, plant your roots near the river of truth and say, no, you move. this was not one of those times.
No. Like you say, even the people involved most deeply were like, you know, if they need to take a little cut of all of this, that's the price of it, right? Yeah. And that's okay.
Yep. And this is where we kind of start to see it, where D&D is following the same pattern that other media forms have been taking.
Nailed it.
You know? Yep,
and that's exactly why take a small community, intimate community of any kind that has grown to love that community, and suddenly comes in to say, this is all very nice. I like your community. We love your community. It's even making us a little bit money. Here's how you're going to change your community.
Yeah.
Bum, bum, bum.
We like what you've got, but I have thoughts.
And the way that that relationship manifested in D&D was management having thoughts, and management being composed of, by and large, people of business backgrounds that weren't, especially in the early editions, but it's a trend that continues, people who don't play the game are in charge of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And they're making decisions related to it and not understanding the ripple effect that that's going to have, either, you know, in the nuts and bolts of playing the game, or, as is more often the case, in the community around it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Part of what tipped the D&D fan base against this OGL so much so quickly was an earlier leaked email from one of Hasbro's marketing people indicating that it was felt that D&D was under-monetized.
Wow.
Yeah, you love that language when you're talking about something that's not... Yes, there's business acknowledgement. Okay, people making money. But there are things in life that, yes, they might be a business, they're also more than that. And they hold a lot of love, a lot of family feelings, a lot of community feelings about it. And it's more than just business, right?
This is a lifestyle,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, like, under-monetized. It's like saying, yes, I like to be married, but it's under-monetized. Yes, I'm not making nearly enough money as a husband.
There's not a wife stream coming in.
Rosalie, how do you feel about that? How about we more monetization of this marriage?
Oh my gosh, it's like something out of Ready Player One. It would be like your employer giving you notes on how you are conducting your marriage and family life.
Yeah, and that's, you know, even people who aren't involved in D&D itself, and I'm not a D&D player, I just have that loose connection to my brother, and through history, loose, you know, dropping in from time to time with friends who would play it and that kind of thing. But even people who aren't part of that community can understand when a community is dictated to that way,
mm-hmm.
and is told you have to change, not just because maybe they're doing something wrong, okay? And actually, I mean, we had interesting examples of people stepped in to say, look, this is not good language. This is racist language. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, gendered language, abusive, violent, all of those things. When those things are called out, okay. But when you try to come in to change what works in a loving community, and I'm going to openly say that about D&D, it's a really affectionate community, it seems like. Yeah, big problems.
It must be tone deaf at the top, right? Because you have a franchise, an IP, that people hold very near, and we're here today because you love it, right?
Absolutely.
That people hold near dear to the heart. I'm thinking, if I'm at the top, I'm thinking, wow, I don't know anything about this sort of community. Why don't we ask the community what they want as far as like feedback, you know, like what could we, you know, like what could we do better about this game? But I realize I might be dreaming a little bit.
That's
but like,
so socialist, you know.
But I'm thinking to myself, if I have, but I like money, right? I do. Yeah. If I'm a business, of course, sure. I'm in it. I'm not in it just for love.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But like, if I love money, I would probably want to ask my customers why they love the product so much. What would you like to see, right?
And to the very great credit of subsequent D&D creators, largely on the design and the creative side, but, you know, business had to sign off on this too. Like, they're working on, for the 50th anniversary, the centerpiece of their plans was a new release of the three core rulebooks. And this re-release has been... It was always going to be terribly fraught. Every time these core rulebooks are re-released, it's always enormously divisive among fans. Up until this version, up until this year, every time this re-release happened, it was called a new edition. And each new edition, the fan base splintered into fans who refused to move on from the rules they were familiar with, and the fans who were eager to see if, you know, perceived shortcomings were addressed, or, you know, who are just interested to try something new. This time around, they're trying to split the difference. They're saying that this is not a new edition. They're making some changes, they're doing some updating, but it's going to be backward compatible to everything they've published since 2014.
Okay.
So anything that you've bought since this most recent edition of Dungeons & Dragons will still work. This claim is similar to ones that they've made on edition updates in the past.
Okay.
So there is some reason to be skeptical of it.
Well, it sounds a little like church. You know, every new denomination says, okay, right, we're gonna do this thing. We're gonna keep the core intact. You know, we're not gonna say we're not members of the faith, but I like the backwards compatibility metaphor for that too. Yes, it's backwards compatible right through year zero.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. But yeah, it's and yet the comparison to a church is, on the one hand, a little bit fraught given the satanic panic, but
oh sure, yeah. Bring that up, why don't you? Yeah,
I like
you win this round.
I was just thinking fragmentation. Yeah. You went dark.
Wins,
but it, he went but dark Matt on us.
There is an apt comparison, only in so far as D&D does often give community to people who feel like they don't have it elsewhere.
For sure.
You know, absolutely. You know, there's a proportion of like, of people who come into D&D because, you know, they like the performance aspect of it. They like playing characters. They like improvising. Yeah. And there's a real theatrical kind of aspect. D&D is a great, improv practice, if you're an actor, because you have to make decisions based on what other what other players are doing and kind
of... One of the things that really strikes me about... And when you first approached me, I assumed you meant online gaming. Like networked gaming and the shooters and all of that stuff that's so huge now. And you talked about the rejection of the monetization of that. Well, you weren't actually talking about that, but that's what I thought you meant. But one of the things that I was kind of pondering was that does create community, but it also creates a safe place for people who don't necessarily have many other safe places. And I'm sure our listeners can relate to hearing about things like video games or Dungeons and Dragons or cosplay or all of these things that aren't the traditional safe places. And for all the criticisms of gaming, whether it's online or whether it's Dungeons and Dragons, it's still creating a space. You know, and you're messing with that.
What I perceive a lot of D&D fans are really worried about in this revision is that the Leafs are going in a sort of Maple Leafs direction, where the cost to onboard, the cost of the ticket, is continually rising to the point that it's going to price the community out of what it built. And to a degree, that's true with any niche, you know, a niche product,
especially
Marvel,
nowadays.
Like Marvel Comics, it was true. You know, the fans of the book feel ownership of it because you may have done nothing but shelled out your nickels month over month, but you kept the lights on at Marvel Comics, and the company itself makes a big show out of being responsive to your needs, to reading your letters and responding. The Marvel's whole identity was built on Stan the Man talking back to the fans. Similarly, D&D from the year 2000 to present took the position of, you know, here's the OGL. We're an open book. You know, tell us what you want. And in the run-up to this new version for the 50th anniversary, they did an extended open playtest where they published and disseminated over the internet. Anyone could download this in-development material and try it out. And then, you know, periodically there would be surveys. Because I think the balancing act they're trying to do is they're trying to please players who have been in this version of the game since 2014, who are starting to get tired of the out-of-the-box options, but they're also trying to onboard new players.
Yeah.
So for one group, you need to add more complexity. For the other group, you have to keep it simple and fun.
Yeah. Wow, it sounds like an impossible task. I mean, we have to be realistic about the fact that when you try to please everybody, very few people are satisfied, right? You use the phrase snatching failure from the jaws of success, right? Because D&D, like, and so many things, I think Marvel is a great example of this. It's just become too big to do anything creative with. It's too big to succeed now, especially when you try to get everybody giving their opinions on it. It's too big. You can't sort of put it all back in the box, so to speak.
And you lose creativity when they get that big too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
the investment from the management side is so high that, you know, they're not looking at, you know, you're risking, you know, X amount of money, you're risking billions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's true. Well, the money thing.
Back when D&D was run by its co-creator, Gary Gygax, when gamers were running the company, creativity abounded, but the business side of the business was just in tatters.
Yeah, sure.
They were making bad investments left and right.
Yep.
They were working out of an old hotel where the roof had been rotted through, and designers would regularly dare each other to climb into the rafters and hop.
Yeah. we're talking about, I used the word case study at the beginning. There's so many case studies of companies that began from that heart place. They wanted to expand because something was so beloved. And they're like, we want to throw ourselves into this, our resource, our investments into it. And it just kind of got a little sloppy. Yeah.
When you have so many people playing it and you have the game in so many different people's lives now, you really can't run it like a frat house anymore.
No, you can't.
Yep, right. And that is a valid position for management to take. And I think the community over this year, like over the run up to this 50th anniversary, has very much been its own worst enemy, in that a lot of the perceived newer players who come from a greater ethnic and racial diversity are looking at some of the outdated language of the game and, you know, versions of the game that was a little bit more racially prescriptive.
Okay.
It's the way of reading Tolkien that says, if you are an elf, you must have these traits. If you are a dwarf, you must have these traits. If you happen to be born an orc or from the east, you're automatically evil.
Yeah.
And that don't fly anymore.
No,
and nor should it.
Nor should it. And those kinds of criticisms are so legitimate.
Yeah, in that way, like management's push to bring more diversity into the game, I think is a good thing. I just wish management was better at it.
Yeah, well, and so many things when you talk about different communities.
Yeah.
I think that's a great spot to wrap up. Matt, thanks so much for being here. Oh. It's been a real privilege having you here. And we'll watch. We'll keep our eyes open, won't we?
Absolutely,
for sure.
And a huge thank you again to Matt Spearglass for reaching out with the idea for this episode and for scratching my 1980s nostalgia. And oh, that lead poisoning. My brother did the little D&D miniatures and I did little lead military miniatures.
Uh-huh.
So much lead. Amazing. So much lead.
Amazing you could have kids.
Right. Well, and thank you again to Matt for scratching the surface on a 50-year saga of Dungeons & Dragons. I would never have known if he hadn't reached out.
Same.
So I feel like there'd be a whole lot more to say. Maybe we'll have him back on sometime.
And as always, we're eager to hear your stories and ideas. Reach out through email at rejectedcentral8@gmail.com, our website at rejectedcentral.com, or through all social media.
Finally, thanks again to you, the listener. You're the reason we're here and the reason we're having such a ball. So Absolutely. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you and so long.